Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and boy, what a show I have got with Michael Kester today.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
What are the movies we're doing?
We're doing Gummo and Pink Flamingos.
Oh, man. So I don't know what to call this culture yet, but and I guess we'll talk about it on the show itself. We'll kind of get into the deeper roots here. But I think this was sort of opposing views of kind of trash culture.
Yeah,
you know,
that's something like that.
Of kind, I don't want to say poverty necessarily, but
It's somewhere. And I
trash
also
seems too simple.
It seems a little offensive,
right? Well, there's the cynical look and there's the champion look.
Yeah,
and you can't, you know, the funny thing is, if I could say easily trash culture, I would say, oh, Pink Flamingos is the trash culture film.
Yeah, sure. What's,
but that's
the trash,
the champion
culture bible
film, right? Well, that too. There's going to be spoilers. I don't know how many spoilers there's going to be, because instead of doing prep today, I just watched the Umshiniwam video. So we'll probably talk about that too. But I think we'll talk about that in the Gummo section, which will be first.
Right.
So you can use the chapters in our show to skip over Gummo if you haven't actually seen Gummo.
Uh-huh.
And you could skip Pink Flamingos if you hadn't seen that particular John Waters film.
Yeah, because of all the John Waters films we've covered on Double Feature, Pink Flamingos is the one you haven't seen.
Gummo was written and directed by Harmony Korine.
Who's a man.
Yeah, Harmony Korine, we've not talked about a ton on the show before, but strangely we have covered.
Yeah, well, and strangely we have covered is probably the most understated way you could have put that. We covered him strangely. Harmony Korine was the director-writer of Kids.
The writer of Kids. That was director Larry Clark.
Right,
on
who
Kids.
We did talk about at length. But yeah. Harmony Korine was the writer of Kids. Just a notable subversive filmmaker.
Sure.
Has done a lot of films like Gummo and like Kids since then. A lot of work with, you know, old Chloe.
Yeah, right.
And
to talk about Chloe again. I'm excited. You know, I love that.
Yeah, especially a movie where Chloe looks like Yolandi.
You're trying to distract me already.
I think equal things to say about Gummo and Umshiniwam.
Oh, God.
We could have probably done just a double feature on that, but it would have gone an hour and a half.
Okay,
and
before we alienate everybody who doesn't know what you're talking about.
Right.
I want to stick to the Larry Clark stuff a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Larry Clark.
Well, I mean, okay. So this has nothing to do with Larry Clark today.
Okay.
But we threw Kids on the show because we thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Last year.
Like that.
And I mean, we had a great conversation. I really loved that show.
I think we threw Kids on the show because we wanted to play the joke that had been played on us, on everyone.
Sure, sure. But when we did it, it was sort of surprise. Harmony Korine landed on our show.
Right.
I don't know how that took so long or how he found a spot here.
Yeah,
both of those things.
Something
were,
like, yeah, right,
but
in the middle.
So we're watching this now, and I want to compare it a little bit to Kids, just because if everybody's been following along for all these years of Double Feature, they've seen Kids previously.
Sure.
And to contrast these two works, now Harmony's directing, not just writing.
Right.
This has nothing to do with Larry Clark. Mm-hmm. He's completely out of the picture. But I'm interested in how similar the two films are.
Well, I think with a visual aesthetic and kind of, you know, the way that the raw way that the shots
are
told.
Sure, sure.
I think that there's a huge, obvious comparison to the Larry Clark film,
mm-hmm.
Kids. But the biggest difference for me is, one, I think that Gummo paints far more of a portrait instead
right.
of telling any sort of a story.
Sure.
And
sure.
And I have a lot to say about that. But Kids was, I mean, despite a lot of contention, Kids did have a plot.
Yeah.
If only
there's a narrative there.
Sure.
Where there isn't as much here.
Gummo absolutely has no narrative.
Right. By design.
I think a lot of the theme of the film revolves around the fact that there is no narrative.
Well, you don't create a fucking nihilistic movie and then give it a straightforward plot.
Right.
I mean, if you're gonna really do some justice to nihilism, you're also going to say fuck plot. We don't need plot.
Right. And if you're going to hit a white trash town with a tornado. Sure. They're not doing anything.
Sure, yeah.
What are they doing at that point? When you go through all of their homes and all of their businesses with a fucking natural disaster, they're going to spend weeks doing nothing.
Yep.
You can't follow a plot. I mean, the closest thing to a plot in the film is wiping out cats.
Sure.
Which is just this gross analogy to, you know, bringing people out of their shelter and now everybody's a fucking stray.
Yeah.
And you hit the nail on the head when you said nihilistic portrait. You know, it's it's a film that is just about being and how when left to your own devices, your being can be your own downfall. Sure. Even when you're not doing anything, even if you're just surrounded by it.
It's great that you can look at this and immediately see all those differences between kids, because I was struck so much to go, you know, as a director centric person myself, I see a Larry Clark movie and I see a Harmony Korine movie. And the fact they are similar, really, in any way, makes me go, well, one, was Harmony Korine inspired by his work with Larry Clark? But maybe more so, is this just kind of a genre now?
Yeah.
You know, this sort of independence.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the Bellflower thing about mumblecore.
Like, yeah, right.
Again, I have no fucking idea what mumblecore
still
is.
Still no idea. Probably never any idea.
This seems like something that I would call mumblecore. Again, no idea.
Right. You did. I think kids came up in that conversation, if I remember.
But, you know, a film that I think draws a lot of parallels to Gummo, and this will be shocking probably just to you, Eric Ingram, but not to anybody in Podmanity, because it's been probably at least 8 days since we've mentioned Rob Zombie.
Oh, great.
Is House of a Thousand Corpses.
Really?
I feel like Gummo and that film are both painting this picture of a place,
right?
And the people are in it, but it's not the focus of the film.
Sure. Okay.
And if you know, you look at something like House of a Thousand Corpses, it's, you know, the backwoods South, and it's that house, and it's you know, the murder ride and whatever.
Although, but these are two very different kinds of South.
Right, that's true. But the House of a Thousand Corpses thing that also I think is a direct parallel is that do you remember how in House of a Thousand Corpses it jumps back and forth between, I want to say narrative, but for the sake of Gummo, I'm just going to say film, and then short kind of almost testimonials of the crazy people that are around, but that aren't involved in the filmmaking.
Right.
There's the scene where the guy has his shotgun pointed at the camera and he's going on about, you know, aliens. And the other scene where the woman and her husband are talking about how she had sexual relations with Bigfoot.
Sure.
Gummo has that same thing where Harmony Korine goes out, finds people actually from this town.
Yeah.
And basically turns the camera on and they beat the shit out of each other in their kitchen.
Right.
And it's just as fucked up and uncomfortable as the semi-scripted, you know, stuff with big name actors like Chloe Sevigny.
Right. Big name actors like Chloe Sevigny.
Comparatively.
Maybe it's the Sevigny that's making me think Larry Clark too. But yeah, it's that environment, you know, it's the cheap poverty and the dirt and the morally bankrupt kids, I guess. You already brought up one of the most impactful choices that sets this apart, though, and that is, I just want to call it nihilism.
Yeah.
Can we just call it like filmmaking nihilism? Sure. But it's that lack of structure or that lack of narrative, that kind of, you know, if you think about nihilism as there is no meaning, there's no point, and really, you know, I always think about nihilism pessimistically. I suppose you could have an optimistic take on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there just is nothing. And doing a film structurally to have no structure to it is almost a tribute to the content of your movie. So we have this collection of scenes, and when you think back to it, it kind of, I mean, it creates its own narrative by force, really.
Yeah.
When you have a collection of scenes and you finish, I mean, I think the audience naturally goes, so what was that about?
Well, yeah, and I think that that's what I love about Gummo, is that it does the thing that you and I love to talk about. It's a film that presents the audience with a bunch of art, a bunch of, you know, work, the product of days of planning and filming and writing and whatever. And then it goes, okay, figure out what I'm saying.
Yeah, right.
Because it's there. I think that Gummo says so much in its simplicity by not giving you a storyline. I feel like oftentimes giving somebody a plot is a way for half the audience to tune out to what the film is actually saying. Because if you have a plot, then when the film is over and the plot is resolved, 50% of an audience has seen the film.
Yeah, it's
the other 50% of the audience is still going to cook on it, find the themes, figure out the why of the plot and why the characters do this and that. But a plot is just an easy scapegoat to make a film accessible.
Sure.
And you take that away, and that makes the film more difficult, but almost a deeper trip into the discovery of it for the viewer, if you give a shit.
Well, okay, so let's do something a little dangerous then. I'm going to disregard this entire iPad full of notes here, because we've kind of come up against something, the question of why.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're done with the movie,
In Gummo, I was so floored by the time this film ended. I had so much to say and so much going on because, I mean, you and I, we're both humanists. We both think, you know, thumbs up, go people.
Yeah.
And this film seems to be railing really hard at times against that.
It does,
and there are people, and I even hesitate to say characters because they seem like real human beings in the film that I feel like, and I don't mean this in the horrific way it sounds, but I think in the context of the film, there are people who are just a waste.
Sure.
The guy that I'm thinking of specifically is the one who beats the shit out of the chair.
Yeah,
loses the arm wrestling match.
Yeah, right.
And he's
why? Because he can't win an arm wrestling match.
Right.
Well, worthless.
That's it. No. Worthless human being. I mean, he's what is he doing? You know what? And that's kind of the question of the whole film: is what are these people doing?
Right.
You know, if you're looking at it from an acting standpoint, which I hate to do.
So let's do it.
What is their motivation?
Right.
Why are they doing this? And I think that the characters don't provide their own depth the way that actors tend to do that. You have the lead who gets that long speech about how he's the poster child and he's like he could be a hero and he could really be somebody. He's got all the makings of this.
Sure.
And then you're introduced to him and you see that he's just fucking terrible.
Right.
And that's when you realize that that's where you are.
Sure.
You're in a world where this guy is the hero.
Right.
And so everyone around him, he is the one that they're kind of trying to be and that they hope to be. And he's this picture of the next generation.
Sure.
And you realize that the other kid, what's his name, Solomon, he shows these signs of getting out of it and wanting to be more human and wanting to be, you know, something more than just stuck in this broken town.
Right.
But he's too busy being led in a generation whose leader is this fucking cat killer.
Yeah.
It's this sad image where you see, you know, a glimmer of potential in a dying city.
Sure.
And you realize that that glimmer is looking up to the end of itself.
Right.
And I know I'm starting to talk really heady, but that's what I think the film presents to the viewer is this idea that your surroundings and
society you live in really kind of sets some boundaries for what you can accomplish.
Yeah. And it's sad because a lot of people, you know, where our generation is particularly guilty, where we grew up being told you can do whatever you want.
Sure.
You can be whatever you set your mind to. If you want it, you know, believe it, you can achieve it.
Sure.
And, you know, then the fucking financial problems or whatever hit and it becomes abundantly clear that you are still limited by where you are, who you were born to, what's around you, who you know. The limitations start piling up.
Yeah.
And it's really jarring to a generation of people who are told, you know, believe in your dreams. Follow your heart.
Yeah.
And it's just a reflection on this whole society in Gummo where you have this kid and he goes in and there's that scene that the one I always remember with Cassie, you know, the mentally handicapped girl who her brother pimps her out. And you have Solomon, I think his name is Solomon.
Good job.
You have Solomon going in there and he's, you know, talking to her and do you love me? And do you think I'm handsome?
Sure.
And he's trying to create something real in this disgusting bubble.
Right.
He's constantly striving to better himself. He's constantly striving to find reality in these people, but he's living surrounded by people that tell him, you know, get drunk, beat up a chair, have a good time.
Well, even if you think about that scene, you know, the don't smile, I'm gonna kill you scene.
Yeah.
Which I mean that whole scene is really bizarre. You have the kind of tap dancing mom figure and the malnourished kid pumping weights, but she's telling him, you know, stop pumping all those weights. Look at how your shoulders are sticking out, you know. And then she starts dancing close up to the camera doing ostrich moves.
Yeah.
So that happens too. Feels like we're back watching Todd Browning's Freaks a little bit. But yeah, the thing I like so much about Gummo is that it's in direct opposition to something like Atlas Shrugged, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I talk about Atlas Shrugged all the time as, you know, when we had that TV promise of follow your dreams and then society kind of set the restrictions. Atlas Shrugged was always that thing I looked at as the the ideal, you know, that was the follow your heart kind of thing for me. Yeah. It was the business plan. It was the roadmap of success. Atlas Shrugged is a piece that basically says, you know, all of these people are driven. It looks specifically at all of their motivations. And it says every single thing they do, it's the opposite of nihilism, yeah. really. So much so that it says, well, what if we create a society just of people who are driven? You know, what does that society look like? And then you turn and look at Gummo and it says, what if you're surrounded by people who do nothing?
Yeah.
You have no resources and you have, I mean, things like motivation come to mind for me for, you know, when your peers are holding you up to something.
Yeah.
If you, I just started watching the Aaron Sorkin thing, Newsroom.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We really need to do more Sorkin on this show, by the way. The we totally missed out on The Social Network because I wasn't even really aware of the Sorkin thing, but just fucking magnificent writer. But seeing someone surrounded by people who are all trying to be the best at what they're doing.
Yeah.
Just by osmosis makes you fucking better. Sure. It makes you driven. It makes you think about it all the time. It's like when all of your friends are into a particular movie, you know, it gets you excited about it. And that's the thing missing from Gummo. And that's the thing that makes it, I mean, this poor fucking kid, the fact that it looks like he's trying to achieve anything at all is a fucking miracle compared to, you know, when he talks to anybody else about anything, they're just smashing his dreams, you know, left and right. I think if there's anything that drives any of these people, it might be self-image.
Yeah.
That seems to be the only thing they have, you know.
Sure.
Even a word like concern about. I mean, what are these people concerned with? What are they, you know, it seems like even the basic elements of food, shelter, not important.
No.
There's really nothing that's important to them.
Yeah, I think
but it's... But maybe taping up their boobs and shaving off their eyebrows and, you know, that might be the only thing. I mean...
Yeah. I think a lot of what motivates these people is each other. And I think that's why it's a downward spiral.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, yeah, I think self-image is exactly what it is. I think they're out, you know, their houses are destroyed. They're out in their front lawns on lawn chairs and people they know are around and they want to be okay. You know, they're just kind of bored and they're looking to everybody else. They're looking to for the first person who's going to start trying to rebuild.
Sure.
But they don't want to be that person because, I mean, again, you have everybody just knocking everybody down for trying to make any improvements.
Right.
And
but you mentioned earlier humanism. I mean, I think we both start with the premise that people are basically good.
Yeah.
Most people are basically good.
Yeah.
Where is the good in these people?
Well, I don't think that...
Is it in there?
I don't think that they're bad people. Mm-hmm. I think that they're...
just torturing animals and, you know, cutting off someone's life support.
Well, you know, that's all one guy.
Yeah,
and like I said, that's the guy that everybody is now looking up to.
Yeah, right.
You have...
Well, because he's the only one with any kind of drive.
Yeah,
even
exactly.
Even if it's in a negative direction.
And it's this fantastic thought experiment where what if you have a bunch of uneducated... decent human beings who are all being led by the one motivated evil human being.
Sure. Something that gets me back to humanism though is I kind of feel like this is a real place, right? I mean, places like this really exist, don't they? Have you ever been anywhere that just you ever been around this kind of, I mean, the poverty is one thing.
Sure.
When I think about, so there's few times in my life, very few times that I've been around an environment like this, but I have seen it.
Yeah.
Towns I've been to where, I mean, I hate to just pick on the South. We champion the South all the time, so that's fine. But it's the few instances I've been in the South in towns where there aren't a lot of people, and it's just this kind of, you know, the idea me going down there and going, great, what are we going to do today? What's on the agenda? The word agenda, I mean, I might as well be speaking another language down there. You know, there's not to say down in the South, but in these particular places I've been, places in Tennessee specifically. Sure. Outside the city in kind of Tennessee suburbs where no one has anything to do all day.
Yeah.
You kind of just get up and you do whatever's in front of you. You think moment to moment until eventually you go to sleep. It's a bleak and a depressing existence, but I think a movie like Gummo needs to exist to remind us it's there if we're not around it, because it's important in a representation of reality, not just to constantly go, here's how life should be. Here's the fountainhead. Here's the ideal. Here's what everyone should strive towards. But also once in a while to say, also this thing exists. Even if just to go, well, this is why we're driven. So this doesn't happen.
Sure.
Because that's the easy thing to happen.
Right.
that's what happens when we all stop being driven. You know, that's where we all live then.
Well, and I think it's scary because it's all based on this idea that, I mean, we don't get to see the functionality of the town before it gets hit by a natural disaster. And I think that that kind of nebulous idea of this could have been a functional town.
Right.
But at
maybe
this
just
point,
so much apathy, you know, something catastrophic happens and no one cares to pick
up
after
it. It's so crippling to imagine. I mean, just think about in your life, think about you're here in Chicago, a fucking, I don't know, tornado, say, goes through, rips your apartment apart. What do you do? I mean, I can tell you for the first, at least for the first few hours, you go to a cafe and you sit there.
Yeah, right.
You do nothing is what you do.
Well, I mean, there's the moment of shock and then there's that moment that's supposed to come afterwards of, all right, time to create a plan.
Yeah.
That's what you do after a fucking disaster. Sure. You go, this was terrible. Okay, now what? And the okay, now what doesn't seem to happen.
Right.
Instead, there's the crutches. There's, let's, you know, drink a beer and we'll wrestle a fucking chair, you know?
Yeah.
The kind of poverty that's on display is really one of the things that's the most astonishing. You know, that kid takes the picture down in that scene and just the bunch of bugs crawling out. And it's as if everything in the entire movie has this kind of thick, filmy, scuzzy coating over it. It's why I don't go in thrift stores. It's it just feels gross to me. The worst is probably that black bathwater.
Yeah.
You know, that feels like by the time we get there, you barely even notice it.
Right.
You know, you have to stop and go, oh yeah, that is black bathwater, but it just seems so right at home with everything else that's, you know, that we're around. It's the poverty mixed with alcohol, I guess.
Yeah.
That helps create a lot of that apathy, that helps create wrestling the, you know, the cheap metal chair or whatever. That scene, so apparently when they filmed that scene, none of the creators of the movie were around for it. They kind of just threw all the actors in a room, gave them some cameras and told them to have at it.
Uh-huh.
Wanted to just create natural moments. But a lot of the techniques they're using to create these natural moments makes this feel, I mean, if we can look at this as a reminder that this place exists and these people exist and they're a product of things that live inside every fucking human being, then the way you really hit that home is to make it look as natural and real as possible.
Right.
Make it look, you know, as close to documentary as possible, even more so than documentary. Because when you have a documentary, you think about, oh, there's the layer removed of the people who are making it looking in. This is just, it's a documentary made by the people who live there. You know, and that makes it fucking scary. That kind of poverty doesn't always have to be gross and disgusting, though.
Yeah.
You have Zeph. You have Posh and Poverty, which is my favorite new thing of all time. I know you're giddy to talk about this.
I am.
And maybe it's just the albino in the film that's making me think about it, or the Harmony Korine. I've had this recent fascination with albinos. I don't know why. It's a fucking aesthetic thing.
Is it a Da Vinci Code thing?
It's definitely not a Da Vinci Code thing. That's one thing we can rule out. You know, we mentioned previously on the show, the Antwoord or Die Antwoord, the South African group. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I think
we didn't really touch on it a lot in the year end.
Well, they started off as just, you know, a rap group out of South Africa. And
this is before doing stuff with Harmony Korine.
Right. This is before doing stuff with Harmony Korine, but after, have you heard about all the previous projects that they did?
Yeah, I'm aware of them. I haven't gotten into any of that yet.
So Die Antwoord is this fantastic piece of art. It's, I mean, basically it's rap rave now. Their new record has brought on the term rap rave. It's basically ghetto fare, but it's from South Africa, where poverty is actually poor, instead of South Central LA, where poverty is kind of a bummer. They're this art, fantastically artistic rap duo, have a wonderful grasp on how rap is and how rap is perceived.
Sure.
And they constantly get shit for whether or not it's performance art.
Sure.
There's been a lot of talking about how Ninja, the front man, all the previous projects, he was not gangsta at all.
Ah.
Not even a little. He used to wear suits. Sure. He used to be very...
I can see that. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, he used to be very well-spoken. All of their... The rap was really articulate, you know, trying to make a difference type rap. And eventually he just said, fuck this. This isn't working. I'm going in from the inside. Ninja comes out, and he once stated in an interview, Ninja is like Superman to Clark Kent.
Right, right.
Only I never take the fucking cape off.
Sure, sure.
It's
perfect because, so it's, you know, it's these two people.
Yeah.
They're from South Africa. It's three people.
Yeah, it's Ninja, Yolandi Visser, and DJ High Tech.
Oh, of course, DJ High Tech.
Yeah, he'll fuck you in the ass.
How could I
white boy
forget? If people haven't heard these albums, there's, I think, Tensions.
Tension.
I mean, Tensions, sure. Where it's at. That's
that came
where
out
start
in February.
You work back.
February 2012.
Well, the duo, I mean, they resemble, it's as if some kids in South Africa had found a bunch of rap magazines.
Yes.
You know? But when you compare that to, say, L.A. Poverty, or let's say Uptown Double Feature Studio Poverty, I mean, here we can work off a budget.
Sure.
Or in L.A., you can work off a budget. You live paycheck to paycheck, but you make decisions about what to buy.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're talking about African levels of poverty, South Africa's probably a little bit better off than most of Africa.
And it's not all Zeph. Yeah. I mean, that's just that's the Uptown to South Africa.
Well, you think about... You know, you get some money, and it's not a, it's like you found a prize.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of, oh, how do I pay my bills or ration out, whatever. You're so poverty stricken that when you find money, it's a little reward you won. And this idea of Zeph is that it's kind of a culture now where you basically, you're in poverty, you have nothing, but when you acquire a sum of money, you use it for bling.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You use it for posh. It's this idea of posh and poverty. So every time you find a little thing you can achieve, you use it for fucking gold fronts or to bleach your hair. You know what I mean? You use it on image.
And you end up looking absolutely unique.
Yeah.
It's an
incredible aesthetic.
The Zeph aesthetic is unprecedented.
It's amazing.
In any visual sense, which is probably why Harmony Korine was drawn to it.
Yeah, so talk about that short a little bit.
Yeah, so D'Antwoord, they're not exclusively a musical group. They're a musical focus group, but they have a lot
a musical focus group, I love
that. They have
a
lot of film, video, music video
mm-hmm.
ideas, and that's a big part of them
right.
as a performance piece.
Sure. And they work with other, you know, especially in South Africa, a lot of the artists kind of work at a collective.
Like in the Enter the Ninja video, mm-hmm. they had that visual artist.
Well, and I think you Freaky too. I mean, all of those are... Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, you're right. But it's kind of subversive in the way that you can't figure out what they're subverting or how they're subverting
sure.
it, but you know that most people aren't going to be okay with it.
Sure.
And
I think it's that rebel without a cause idea.
Right.
It's that subversion of, well, we don't really have anything to subvert, but we see culture over here doing it.
Yeah.
It's almost a commentary on rap culture.
Sure.
Up to the point where it realizes a commentary on rap culture would be redundant and unnecessary.
Yeah.
So it's kind of just... It's its own unique thing.
Yeah.
You really just need to look at it.
And so, yeah, Sheeny Wam is this short film that Harmony Korine did. And it's about these two people, and they get pretty blinging wheelchairs, and there's a lot of guns and a lot of nihilism and a lot of heart.
Yeah.
And it stars Ninja and Yolandi. And, I mean, it's online. You can
I'll
find
link
it
off
online.
To it. I'll link off to it. You know, it's kind of a nice note to end on with such a portrait of hopelessness with this movie. But I want to look at the other side, too. I want to look at the Pink Flamingo side.
Oh, that's a big side of it.
Well, you have to have direct opposition to something like you know, what Korine's
presenting.
Yeah,
this was a good pair.
It was. We have to make time to pat ourselves on the back again. I think, one, Pink Flamingos I'm excited to talk about because finally our constant conversations about the mainstream debate of where John Waters mainstream branched off, whatever,
blah,
began.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, this is deep in Dreamlanders territory.
Yeah.
We're nowhere. Although the argument could be made, it's the most well-known of the Dreamlanders films.
That's true.
And thusly, the mainstream one. But I will not make that argument. The Dreamlanders, I've referenced before on the show, that is the old school John Waters troupe that honestly, you know, made its way through a lot of his films.
Yeah, and I always forget that they're called the Dreamlanders, and
yeah.
every time
oh, isn't
you
that
mention
the best?
It, it makes me so excited.
Yeah, because there's almost something ironic about it.
Sure.
But not really.
I mean, it's
dream and it's heart.
Yeah, I feel like it's it's not ironic, which is what I love about
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
right. It's John Waters and his friends, and they want to make movies, and he
yep.
wants to make movies.
And so they're going to.
And they're
going to
fucking make movies.
Yeah.
And they're going to make whatever movies they want, and it works.
Sure, it does. Yes, it did. Mink Stole, who, by the way, Mink Stole, red hair in this movie, and maybe it's the other names that I'm going to drop. Mink Stole's kind of the hot one.
Yeah.
Am I totally off
like
base
that.
On that?
Mink Stole.
I never thought I'd say that, but
yeah.
Because Edith Massey's not the hot one.
Ugh.
Edith Massey is the egg lady.
I have such a problem with that. I think of all the things that go on in this film, of all the, you know, different holes that sing,
sure.
Of all the different meats that are tied to different genitalia,
yep.
Of all the different bodily matter that gets consumed,
mm-hmm.
Egg lady.
Somehow that
in a
upsets
baby
you
pen
the most.
Is the most uncomfortable.
Also, Divine can't go unrecognized. There'll be lots of Divine chat. But John Waters is kind of. I think John Waters is narrating. That's John Waters,
yeah,
right?
It's got to be.
Yeah, I'm just having so much fun. I'm barely paying attention to who's doing what. I had to pause several times to write things down this time. Pink Flamingos is this cult legend of a movie. It's something I was aware of way before I knew anything about John Waters. I mean, when's the first time you heard about this? Can you remember the first time?
I can.
Yeah?
When I first moved to the city and I met a bunch of people, we all went to Tower Records when Tower Records and physical music
right.
were
so
both things.
So this was 30 years
have.
Ago.
Right. And a guy that I had met and was kind of into film was trying... I wish I remembered the other film he almost bought. But he had...
Might have another double feature on our
hands. He had Pink Flamingos in one hand and another film in another hand. And he was like, I don't know which one of these to buy.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I've never seen either one.
Sure.
And then he holds Pink Flamingos and he goes, someone eats poop in this movie.
Right.
And I said, you should get that one.
Yep.
So he bought it and we immediately went home.
Ooh.
And we watched it, the whole group of us.
Yeah.
And I shit you not, Eric Ingram, by the end of the movie, there were three people left in the room.
Wow.
Yeah.
It actually killed off the audience.
Yes. Yeah. In a college dorm room, it killed off the audience. These
the
are
Aristocrats
people starving
is the only
for
movie
social attention.
Yeah, I've ever seen to do that. That's, you know, I once described John Waters on our show as that perfect feel-good, just kind of... No matter where I'm at, I watch a John Waters movie and everything is just great in the world.
Absolutely.
And this is my first time seeing Pink Flamingos.
Oh, really?
I have been saving Pink Flamingos for the better part of a decade.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, this happens once in a while where I have certain films that I know are going to be great.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to watch them and it's going to be the best fucking moment of my life.
Sure.
And I don't watch them. I save them for when things get bleak and I go nuts.
You did that with Drive.
When I have a little mental relapse.
Yeah.
And although that was shorter term.
It was far shorter.
Drive came out.
That's
sat
the first
on it
one
for
I can
six
think
months.
Of.
But yeah. The sixth Rocky I ended up having to do for the show.
Yeah.
But that was when I was kind of sitting on. And that's what happened with Pink Flamingos too. We put it off for a long time. One, because we were not sure we were ready to go into that old John Waters territory.
Yeah.
But secretly, I had just not seen Pink Flamingos.
Yeah.
And I've seen the other Dreamlander stuff.
Sure.
But not all of it. But I mean, I'm familiar with it. And I just knew this would be so great.
Yeah.
And I needed a rainy day movie. And then time came to do it on the show. And it's just as fucking perfect.
And this is what? This is touted as a trash-o film still?
Sure.
Technically the trash-o films?
Well, yeah. That's when I think of the Dreamlanders movies, that's what I think of.
Yeah. It's a self-given title to the early John Waters films.
Sure.
Including the film Mondo Trash-o.
Yeah.
Where John Waters just makes these movies. And these are pretty heavily based on... Well, we've talked about it before, but I love it. The newspaper articles.
Oh, yeah, right.
Where they fucking decide, you know, it's something that I wish I had the constitution to do.
Sure.
Go out and go, I want to make a movie.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Oh,
today.
Also, what should we do that about?
Yeah, right.
For me, I'm always, well, I've got this idea and I'm going to start writing it.
Sure.
And then I forget, no, maybe that won't work. And
right.
Then I forget it. I'm not doing that. Oh, but I got this other idea and all my scripts end up, you know, 40 pages.
Yep.
John Waters goes, let's make a movie. Who's free today?
Yeah.
It's Saturday, so nobody's fucking working.
Yeah.
Divine is divine. Divine isn't working.
Right. Divine's not working because we haven't come up with the movie idea yet.
Right. So let's, I don't know, pull up a fucking newspaper, read some stupid article, and make a movie about it.
Perfect. It's so, I mean, that's the best way to do stuff.
Yeah.
For me, anyways. That's everything I've ever done that got finished was pretty much something I did the day of. I just went, you know what? I'm not doing anything today. Let's just fucking go do this thing. You and I made that video. We made, it was a music video. You were going to play a show anyways.
Yeah,
that's
true.
It was the thing you were doing. And I was going to go to the show, and I said, I'm going to bring a camera, just make a music video out of it. That's the only, which by the way, that's called Porn Stars and Promises, and you should go look it up.
It's one of the most viewed Glitter Mouse videos on YouTube.
I love that.
Yeah, me too.
But I mean, you just, you have to just go do things, and they look at the obstacle being, well, what do we do about plot? Read a newspaper article. Okay, sure. Let's move.
Well, and it's weird because people will look at Pink Flamingo and go, so what happens in that movie? Most people will go, I don't know, someone eats poop.
Yes.
I know I keep saying that, yes. But that is
that's,
the reaction.
You know, that's what I mean, I knew about Pink Flamingos back in fucking high school. It took me about 10 years to see the movie. And it was one of those things like Faces of Death. Those were the two pieces of subversive, right. You know, film that I knew about when I was younger. And people talked about it as the poop movie.
Right.
That was it. You know?
And it's such a small part of the film, but compared to Gummo, it's got a fucking story.
Sure.
I mean,
sure,
it's got a plot. It really compared to anything else, it's asshole dancing.
Right.
Compared to Gummo, it's about being the nastiest, filthiest person in Baltimore.
Well, it's the competition for filthiest people alive, which really is the perfect plot for, you know, debauchery anything. On screen. But I mean, so we talked about that poop moment, which I love because it's just tacked on the end.
Yeah.
It's just such a... And then the thing you're about to see is Divine as an actor eating poop. Let's watch that now.
Sure.
And then Divine sees a dog and eats some poop, and then the movie ends.
And I mean, it's...
And it's so just, we'll put this on the end in case you questioned the...
But is that, I mean, I've heard, and I don't know, because people say that Marilyn Manson got ribs removed to suck his own dick.
Right. Also a thing I remember from about when this movie came out.
But color scales aside...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know to this day whether or not Divine actually ate that poop.
I'm fairly confident that is real poop and was actually eaten.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that that's at least our stance. I know that it seems really childish to be really.
It does, but it's it's a question they present. I mean, when you introduce the scene as you will now watch Divine eat poop, really it's poop and really Divine will eat it. And then Divine eats some poop. I mean, naturally.
Yeah.
That question might arise. It's, you know, it's great to go through. That's not one of the things that John Waters touches on in kind of the bonus footage for this.
Right.
But there's a great special thing where he kind of gives a walkthrough of the missing scenes and so forth from this. There's if you've never seen the trailer is really great from that. It's, you ever seen the trailer from this movie?
I don't think so.
There is no footage from the movie and the trailer.
Wow.
It's just people's reactions coming out of the theater. It's pretty amazing. You make this movie and you go, we're going to have, you know, make this taboo movie and it's impossible to show in theaters. It's impossible to rate, you know, it'll be banned everywhere. And then the trailer can't even include footage of the fucking movie. The fact that the studio even decided to make a trailer kind of makes me happy. The first thing I notice about this, you know, when I'm thinking about these newer John Waters films that have become a lot more pointed, and it's still some of the same actors and a lot of interesting acting choices. I say interesting really with quotes around it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, I don't know, what do you call them? Taboo acting choices? You could always call the acting choices taboo.
Yeah,
casting choices.
Yeah, I think...
When Johnny Knoxville is the most professional actor.
That's true.
You know, that's where I'm going with this. But looking back at this, this is probably the worst acting we've seen since The Room.
Oh, man.
I mean, acting, I could say that pretty easily.
That's definitely something you could call what's going on in this film.
Well, because you're just making a movie with your friends.
Yeah.
You're having fun and you're learning how to make movies.
And you're telling them the lines literally moments before turning the camera on.
Right,
okay,
right.
Say eggy weggies.
Oh, my God. The simple decision... not to take any of this seriously is what makes it different.
It's
from
true.
The Room. That's, you know, The Room, we put that on the show as one of the rare times we've ever talked about a movie and just kind of tore it apart.
Sure.
Because it was bad.
No, it was never serious.
So yeah, that
we're
like,
okay, well, if it was never serious, we're going to tear it apart.
Well, that was Lisa. That was Tommy Wiseau's big thing. Oh, it's a serious movie. So, you know, we'll handle it on that level. But they look at this and you know everybody in the movie is just giggling every time the camera stops, sometimes even before the camera stops, and having a good time with it, and that, you know, they're all aware they're terrible actors and it's just fun. And it's weird, you know, when you make that decision and you make it obvious you've made that decision on screen, that suddenly it doesn't matter how bad. In fact, the worse the acting gets, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Edith Massey is probably the worst actor in this movie.
Yeah, she's horrible.
If not the, I mean, Edith Massey probably has trouble even functioning as a human being.
Right.
Let alone on screen as a presence, which is the type of people John Waters, you know, finds fascinating and puts in his movies.
Sure.
But yeah, she can't, you know, she's just choking out these lines as if she has no comprehension of what she's talking mm-hmm. about. It's like hearing someone reading something off a page if that person can't read.
Yeah.
That's basically how Edith Massey performs. But it seems unnecessary to even comment on the acting. The thing that was the most surprising about the sort of amateur quality of this was from John Waters, because he tends to be the most professional element of his films.
Right.
The fact that he knows what he's doing and he's really got his finger on the pulse of his subject matter mm-hmm. and his actors, and he has the right level of these things at all times.
Right.
But when we're watching this movie, I mean, he's learning how to make films. He's doing these, I mean, most of these scenes are a single take.
Yeah.
Not because it's a Joss Whedon, you know, Serenity show-off single take, but because he doesn't know that you shoot from multiple angles yeah. and edit together. He's making a fast, he probably knows that, but he's making a fast movie.
Uh-huh.
And every single scene is just turn the camera on, do the scene, then turn the camera off. That's what you do. And then you move to the next scene and you turn the camera on and you film it and you turn the camera back off. He's also doing, you know, he's got a zoom lens. So of course you use it because, uh-huh. you know, that's what you do with a zoom lens. And he's just zooming in and out of, oh, now we're going to focus on this person. Rather than cut to a close up, I'll just zoom in on their face.
Uh-huh.
And then, oh, somebody over there is talking, quick, zoom back out and then move back over to them and zoom in. It's what you do when the first time you ever touch a fucking camera. I'm going to give people a filmmaking tip that's awesome right now. If you suck at shooting movies and your movies come out amateur looking, get what's called a fixed lens, a prime lens. It can't zoom, and then you just don't have that problem.
Yeah.
Because if you have a zoom lens, you're always going to want to zoom into things, and then your stuff is going to look hokey if you don't do it right. And they're cheaper. They're nice, cheap lenses. The actors don't always fit in the frame. I mean, they're clearly not. It's just, where can we put the camera to get the most yep. stuff in here? It's wonderful. It really is. I mean, it's wonderful because you see how far John Waters has come. If this yeah. is all he ever did, then we'd be talking about him like he's Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
I mean, that was the magic of Herschel Gordon Lewis, is somebody who kept making films that never seemed to get better.
Yeah.
They almost seemed to just get worse.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing.
And it's, you know, it's funny too, because I think Herschel Gordon Lewis, I can see a lot of that in this movie. There's a lot
yeah.
of those kind of HGL inspired moments, the cannibalism and stuff.
A lot of our favorite filmmakers around this era are just people who they just turn on a fucking camera and go, okay, movie time.
Yeah, right. But it makes me feel like anyone can do this.
That's why I love it.
Yeah, it's the best thing. I mean, especially when you know newer John Waters movies.
Uh-huh.
It was one thing to see it just on its own. I mean, I don't know what that was like because I saw the newer stuff. I'm not going to pretend I know
fucking
what that
bizarre,
was.
And it made no sense. And I'm pretty sure the only reason I sat through it was because I had a deeper thirst for social acceptance than the people who left the room.
Sure, there you go.
But
you wanted to withstand the test.
Yeah, yeah, and
it was a dare.
It probably affected me from a film standpoint, especially sure. in retrospect.
Well, yeah, and you make the connection, too. You see the later stuff. You see how far he's come and how great his movies have become in their own right, rather than just as novelties.
Right.
And to go, this is where he started, and a famous piece of where he started, makes me feel like, man, pick up a camera and get to
yeah.
work.
Well, and it's so fucking hilarious because you take something like Hairspray.
Sure.
Hairspray had this massive, you know, cult following, turned into a musical, turned into a massive,
sure.
huge blockbuster film.
Sure.
And you know that anybody who loves Hairspray went back and saw the original Hairspray,
yep.
then saw Crybaby,
sure.
then saw Pink Flamingos. Because
yeah.
Pink Flamingos is the third one you see when you start with Hairspray.
Right.
Because you're looking for the most popular John Waters
sure,
movie.
Sure, sure.
And it's Hairspray. And then Crybaby's just the obvious
What
next
a terrible
choice.
Tour of John Waters, by
I know.
The way. It just doesn't make any fucking sense. There are creative moments in this, too, though, that, you know, we're talking about the movie so much. It's just, ha, terrible thing John Waters made. But there are so many moments that where you see a little bit of the genius poke through.
Uh-huh.
Moments like treating Divine like the blonde bombshell, you
yeah.
know, with the music and stuff.
Sure.
As if filmmaker not aware at all that, you know, almost like he couldn't cast a blonde bombshell.
Yeah.
But, you know, Divine lives in this town. So
right.
Same exact movie, same script, same music
yeah.
choices. We're just going to put Divine in where we would have put I keep searching for a name in my head.
Jessica Rabbit.
And then there's the obvious moments of, you know, just pushing things as far as they could go. Cock That's sausage. What they had. Yeah, right. I mean, that kind of, yeah, that hot dog flasher thing, you know, just going as far further, much further, come sure. on, than anybody was willing to go.
Yeah.
That's where you see their, you know, their artistic genius coming mm-hmm. through early. It's the reason this has lived on in infamy, not just what John Waters has become, but that, you know, it had this cult status right away because it pushed things so far. It kind of validated that thing that I talked about on the show before, you know, in a marketplace for artists who aren't or weren't yet skillful yeah. at their craft, but they were willing to do things other people weren't.
Yeah.
And their willingness to go that far made them notable artists, even if they made a film that fucking looked like Pink Flamingos.
Right.
You know, you could talk about the hot dog flasher or fucking a bloody chicken or, you know, all of these moments littered throughout the movie that are just so, they burn themselves in your mind for the terrible, right. wonderful things they do. The foot fucking even comes to mind for not being that, you know, not being one of yeah. the more X-rated scenes. Somehow sitting in a crib eating eggs is still about it's the worst thing
so
that the movie does.
It's so fucked up. And it's so yeah. gross. I mean, I think that, and it is a reverse reflection on the film, is the obsession with just that one fucking thing. You just want yep. to just stop fucking yep. talking about it. And please right. go away and yeah. stop bringing it up. Because
but it's at home in a crib. And right. every time you go home, it's there.
And that's basically, you know, that's a lot of what Pink Flamingos does to the viewer who doesn't get it.
Yep.
Is yeah okay. Stop being fucked up. Stop it. We get it. You're fucked up. Yeah, stop right. being fucked up.
Uh-huh. But eggs, the reality I understand.
Of the reality of the situation is, Pink Flamingos. It's fucked up.
Yeah.
It's just that. Like that's the purpose of the film. Is I mean the plot of the film. You know, it's the whole idea there is to upset people, and yeah. I don't mean to upset people from, you know, say a D'Antwoord perspective.
Sure.
It's in a fun way. It's calling it to question and laughing at you for being upset.
Right, right.
It's going, really, you're that upset over poop. Yeah, it's a butthole, yeah. guys. Come on.
Well, I mean, you know, when I said the egg thing somehow feels like the worst, but it feels like the worst until the asshole variety gag
yeah.
Toward the end. I want to talk about that chicken scene a little okay. bit, too, because we saw some animal abuse in the previous film,
mm-hmm.
and here, you know, it's these people fucking, and then a chicken kind of gets involved, and it's pretty messed up, and, you know, you see this in movies from time to time, and there's always a fucking statement that comes out and goes, oh, we didn't actually harm any animals, you know, in Gummo, we're not harming any animals. In Pink Flamingos, they fucked a chicken. That's a thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a fake stunt chicken that comes in at the end. They bought a chicken from a fucking place that kills chickens for you to eat, and then they fucked it, not to death. I want to say they fucked the chicken to death, but then the cast cooked and ate it. I mean, that was just what happened. So you're watching this, and it gets even worse the more you know about yeah. the film, which is great, because usually there's the cannibal Holocaust thing.
Sure.
Oh, it's the worst thing ever. And then you go, no, guys, it's movie making magic. Come on. Although there was a lot of the animal stuff in that yeah. too, but just thinking about like the cannibalism elements, uh-huh. maybe that was a terrible go-to, but yeah. you know what I mean?
You think about the bicycle seat.
Exactly. You see somebody impaled or whatever, and you go, man, that's brutal. And then the filmmaker draws you a diagram of how they filmed it. And you go, oh, it's not that
that's
bad.
Brilliant.
It's people having fun. Yeah. But here there's no, I mean, they fucked a chicken.
Sure.
The right thing to do. It holds things like this up and it says, you know, they're not that bad. We yeah. ate the chicken. The chicken was going to get eaten anyways. Yeah. It wasn't that bad. You know, there's these moments of filth, but filth kind of, I mean, this is a perfect example of celebration. Filth kind of saves the day.
Yeah.
The flasher is scared off by a hermaphrodite. Uh-huh. I mean, it's, you know, it makes a joke. It's lighthearted, but simultaneously makes the situation another level of fucked up.
Yeah.
The only other thing I guess I really wanted to ask you about is, how the fuck do we get to the end of this movie, me, as a new viewer? And it turns out there's still a trial. There's still yeah, a goddamn
yeah,
trial.
Yeah, a trial. The
not a John Waters movie unless you end on a trial. More trials at doublefeatureshow.com. You can email us, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. Tell us where you were when you first heard about Pink Flamingos. Not when you saw it, but when you first heard about it. And then if that shortly followed with you seeing it, or it took you a long time, or you never saw it.
Or you just chaptered
it
to here.
Yeah, right. If you listen to Gummo and chaptered to here, tell us something about humanism or Die Outward.
Next time we're gonna do some good old fashioned Rodriguez Tarantino double featuring, the one you've been waiting for since the beginning of time, The Faculty, and Jackie Brown.
That's not a
watch more fucking film.
Bye.